Hi, everybody. My name is Steve.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chuck Wendig. I'm just a guy. I'm a writer. I don't know. What do I do? What do I do, Steve?
I think you're basically internet famous for starting serial wars, as far as
that, I did that.
You did. Yeah. As far as I understand, and I've never met you before. I've never heard of you. PR agent was like, talk to this guy, and here you are. I just showed up. It's a little weird. You're in my living room, but you know, whatever.
You know what? I came into the vents. You can't stop me.
Oh, that's sus right there. I love it. So for those of you at home, Chuck and I have known each other for a lot of years now. And we've had many a conversation about, you know, philosophical things along the way. And I really wanted, as this show begins spinning up, to reach out to my most introverted friends that sort of are in touch with the world. And there's not a lot of people I could think of better than Chuck. On the outside, he is a bearded, toting bees in a human skin basket kind of guy. But when you talk to him in person, maybe one of the most real, insightful people I've ever known. So welcome, Chuck, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I would like to tell you what a terrible person I am. I went into my house and I was like, I'm going to have a nice fancy little, you know, podcast time here with my friend Steve, and I'm going to brush my teeth, even though he can't smell whatever my breath is. It's good. I'm brushing my teeth. And then I came out here and I brought this juice, and it's an apple, cucumber, celery, spinach, lemon juice.
Oh, God.
And, my toothpaste is mint.
Oh, so that's...
My mouth is angry. It's very... I mean, I'm going to keep drinking it.
So you're saying that Fruit Roll-Up will be reaching out to you very shortly?
Okay. Toothpaste and cucumber juice.
That sounds horrifying, to be honest with you. So in all these podcasts, I really like to start at the beginning and just kind of give people an idea for, you know, who you are. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. I was born in a barn. We did have a barn, and that was nice. Bucks County, Pennsylvania, you know, pastoral, hilly, that kind of... Although back when I was a kid, it's a little bougie now. It's a little like... Okay. Like people from New York and stuff have moved in. But when I was a kid, there was a lot of farmland, sort of rural, you know. So, like, you could get on my bike and go for, like, 5 miles and there would be no one. And there were no cell phones, and I probably could have died. But that was my youth. Misspent.
Misspent youth. Do you kind of regret that there wasn't that kind of technology back then? Or did you kind of like the era of no technology?
I liked it. I preferred it in many ways. I feel that the technology overall is good, right? But at the same time, it shackles us in ways, and both in terms of, like, I mean, I can't stop looking at my phone. I'm just like, what's on my phone right now? What's on the glowy box? It's telling me doom and joy in equal measure. And I'm like, oh, there's some doom, there's some joy. And it's like warring synaptic nightmares going on in my head. And but then I can also be like, what is all of the knowledge in the world? I can just pull it up, by which I mean, who is that actor? That's what I use my phone with for. Who is that actor? I know them from somewhere.
The Chuck Wendig story. Which actor followed me today? Yeah.
Yeah, I have a few of those too.
Yeah, I know. For those of you who are not familiar with Chuck's Twitter, one of his most defining characteristics is he is a magnet for people who want to follow and have jokes. And it's a pleasure to watch. You tell me, do you think at this point you're more well known for writing or for Twittering?
I don't know. I feel like it kind of depends on who you are. I mean, if you're a Twitter user, you know me. Like, if you're a big Twitter user, if you're extremely online, as the kids say, then you know who I am for being also extremely online. But otherwise, if you're a bookish person, you likely know me there. So it's sort of a weird, like, I straddle those two realms, and they don't always cross over. Like, it's weird when people are like, I didn't know you wrote books. I'm like, really? I talk about books all the time. It's in my head. I write books.
It is weird. I would have never imagined with all the books behind you that you might be into books.
Yeah, it's weird. No, they're not. They're cereal boxes.
Okay. Yeah. That post-sponsorship. Got it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. What do you think you prefer being known for? Do you like being known for being prolific in the thought vomit, as you once told me you call it, or do you prefer the, you know, structured book narrative?
Oh, all books. The Twitter thing is just like, it can die. I hope it dies. Like, it'd be great. I'd be free. I would feel free if it would just go away. And then I'd be like, oh, great. And then I could just go back to writing only books. I mean, I like Twitter a lot. There's a wonderful sort of freedom to it. But it also used to be more like a water cooler. You could kind of hang around and you could do bits with your friends and not worry about who was watching, or, you know, it wasn't really as performative. And now it's a stage and everybody's on the stage and everybody's doing a stand-up bit at one time. And it gets a little weird when people sort of drown each other out. So it gets harder to sort of say things. You can't have a lot of nuance. There's not a lot of realm for measured, even gnarly discussions, even discussions where it's difficult or you're getting something wrong or you're trying to feel a topic out. It's people like sort of stake their tents and build their walls pretty quick, and that's it's tough.
Yeah, was it one Twitter user said the Twitter has a main user every day and your objective is to never be that one user.
Yeah, the main character. Yep. Twitter's main character, Bean Dad or whoever in whatever day. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, just avoid that at all costs.
Yeah. When you see yourself trending, you're like, uh oh. Probably not for something good. Oh. Did I save a kitten? Probably not.
Did I save that kitten? Or do they think that I robbed the kitten of its right to be in a fire?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then they'll confuse it. They'll be like, no, he actually burned the kitten and that's what I heard, and here's a deep fake of him burning kitten. And you're like, oh no. Oh no, I gotta get off.
So it's essentially a game of telephone gone incredibly wrong.
Yes, on methamphetamines. Yeah.
Oof, that's a mental picture right there. Again, I'm talking to the word wizard, so this is what he does. So you know, we're talking about, you know, growing up in the barn days of technology. You know, in school, what kind of academic student were you? Did you love certain subjects above the rest?
I learned, you know, this contrasts with my wife. I learned pretty early on that there were some things in school that I wasn't very interested in. Not to say I wouldn't try at those things, but math, for instance, I do okay. I did fine with math. I was like a B, C student. But when it came to things like English or certain kinds of history, I was really into it. And being really into it helps you do well at them. And that's sort of my view of the idea of quote unquote talent. Like, talent is often just your interests manifested. It's not always necessarily a thing you're quote unquote good at, but it's a thing you like. If it's a thing you like, it tends to be a thing you try to be good at just because you enjoy it more. It sort of tickles your spirit. So yeah, I stopped worrying too much about academic performance. I did well. I didn't tank, but I wasn't always concerned about chasing the A's, you know, the 4.0 or the honors classes or any of that stuff. I was happy to be what I was doing and to just be satisfied with my own performance as opposed to what everyone wanted me to be.
So you're saying you were an A-plus student in all subjects?
All subjects, yeah. I was a genius. I was a Mensa kid. I was gifted in the gifted class, which is like one of those classes where you're like, you know, your day could be like, we're going to sit here and throw darts or we're going to build a computer today. Like, it was just like the days in gifted class were sort of erratic. Wow. And joyfully erratic. Like, I was very happy about that. But they were not always days where you would look in and be like, these are the gifted children. You're like, are they headbutting each other with buckets on? What's happening in there? They're having fun.
Well, sometimes you have to play knights with buckets. It's just
sometimes you got to play knights with buckets. Yeah. The law.
So did that carry on for you when you went to college? Did you excel in many, many ways?
College was easier because, you know, you were forced pretty early on to sort of focus on something. So, yeah, you still had to take a little of this and a little of that. But generally speaking, once I got on the track, yeah, college was much more. I mean, it's just liberating in general because, you know, even now, like watching my own son go through school, I'm amazed at how easy college was compared to like primary, you know, the primary education, elementary school, high school, like the work they pile on you was considerable. Whereas college, like you got a lot of spaces between classes and you had like a lot of time. They tell you with the syllabus when stuff's going to be due. And it's like, I've got a paper due in 3 months and I can either do it now or more likely the night before or on my way to that class, scribbling it furiously. Watching the way homework is with elementary school kids and even into high school, it feels like almost the pressure is way higher on those kids than it is in college.
Yeah, I can see that. Do you feel like that was sort of where your passion for creating these worlds began, or do you think it began in you much earlier?
Oh, earlier. Yeah, I knew I wanted to be a writer. Like, eighth grade was when it sort of sunk into me that I was like, yeah, I didn't know. Like, I just didn't know before then that was a thing you could do in make a living. I don't know how I thought books were produced. I guess it was like, I mean, I knew there were authors because I liked them, but it didn't occur to me that they were doing that as their quote unquote job or career. I was like, I don't know if I thought it was a hobby. I don't know what I thought. Maybe I just didn't worry about it because when you're a kid, you don't. You got to be an astronaut. I don't care. Firefighter, astronaut, dog trainer. Screw you. But eighth grade, I was like, wait. Like, I saved up my money to buy a book, a Robert McCammon book. And I was like, oh, like, I paid for this. Like, this is the thing. Like, I want someone to pay me for this then someday. And then I began working toward that pretty much right at that point.
That's fascinating. Is that when did you feel like it really turned from a, this could be cool, into just the love of your life, just this passion?
It was always love of the life, but it as to how I could do it, there's been many stages of that, of sort of plateaued escalations, because I came out of college and I didn't know what I was doing. I had started to write novels, and they were, we call them trunk novels, but they should be trunk novels in the literal sense. Like, they should be buried in a lead-lined trunk deep in a like a toxic waste site, like a fun site. Because if they ever get out, it's going to be like Poltergeist or Ghostbusters. It's not going to be good. So no one should ever be able to see those books.
I don't want to see that, to be honest, but okay, good.
Yeah, nah, it's not good. So I was doing that, and I was just not doing it well. And for a lot of reasons, I wasn't doing well. I sort of recognized why they weren't good now, but then you just feel kind of hopeless. So I started doing freelance writing for the games industry, pen and paper games particularly. And then I did a hard left into screenwriting and ended up in Sundance Screenwriters Lab. And then I was still trying to write books in that interim. And so I sort of ping-ponged all over the place and just sort of developing skills and voice and confidence in various trenches and bunkers.
Yeah, no, I mean, fortunately for me, I know you, again, because we've known each other for like 3 minutes now. So,
three minutes.
That's right. One of the first times I ever got to meet you in person, you were just outside of Pittsburgh at a local college, and you were telling
us. Yes,
yeah, exactly. And you were telling this lovely story about how you hit a certain point in your age, and you decided it was time to essentially just make your stuff or get off the pot. And, I would love for you to share that story if you're so inclined.
I tried writing 5 books and they were terrible books. I mean, I tried writing more than 5 books. I had, a serial killer's bounty of unfinished murdered novels in my wake. I was able to finish 5 of them. They were terrible. And then I sort of did hit kind of what I feel like was rock bottom, and not necessarily in a overly depressed way, but in a like a rally the troops, last ditch effort, storm the gates kind of thing. I'm like, all right, I'm going to write the book that I want to write. I've been trying to write books that I thought the market wanted to hear. I was trying to write books that aped the voices of other authors, trying to be successful without worrying about my desires for the book. So I started this book called Blackbirds. I threw everything, all the rules out the window. Like, I opened it. She's looking in a mirror, which you're not supposed to open that with. And it's like first or third person present tense, which is a squirrely sort of a thing. And she's theoretically foul-mouthed and unlikable. Not theoretically foul-mouthed, but theoretically unlikable. Even though I love her dearly, she's a nightmare person. She's a garage full of cats on fire. So I kind of just did all this stuff. And that was the book that was the book. It was the book that ended up, after a long and arduous learning how to tell a story process, became the book that ended up on bookshelves.
That's amazing. And I know that you also went at things in reverse as well, where you took a book and then you made a screenplay and then you made the screenplay into a book. And
yeah,
how was it that you decided to both reverse engineer yourself twice?
Well, that was Blackbirds, actually. I decided I was going to write the book, and then I felt like it was going well every time I tried to write it. But I would be, if you've ever gone into a room and you forget why you went into that room, that was me with this book. I would get about 75% of the way through, and then it would just unspool like a ruptured testicle, which is how testicles rupture. Science fact, everybody. So and I'm sorry for everybody who had to hear that, but that's too late.
Educational channel now. All right, there we go.
Yeah, we're doing like a Hank Green educational video about testicles.
That's right.
So yeah, I would have this terrible time getting it going and figuring out what the story was. So that's when I won the screenwriting competition, which is what every novelist does when they're having trouble, they enter a screenwriting competition apparently. And the prize was really a mentorship with a screenwriter, a guy named Steven Susko. And it was great. So, but the first thing he told me to do was like, well, you're gonna have to learn to outline. And I was like, no, we don't outline here in literary world. Like, I know in Hollywood land, you have to put your little laundry list together. But in the literary, you know, we go up and we listen to a pony or we talk to the clouds. That's how our stories come from. And so he's like, well, how's that going for you? I'm like, oh, I get it. I see what you're saying. So, yeah, I grin and I bore it. Is that I grin and bear it, but past tense sounds terrible. Grinned and bore it. Whatever. And I, you know, what's that?
Title of your next book. Good. Yep.
Grinned and bore it. Yep. Chuck, big story. And yeah, from there, then it was like we turned it into an outline and then a screenplay. And then I went right back to a novel because I used the screenplay as a very complicated outline. And I've done it since a few times, turn the thing into a screenplay before putting it into prose. It's a nice kind of bare bones outline.
Wow. That's an interesting, I think, writing tip there for those of us who are watching who like to write, but also.
Yeah. Because I mean, like a script is just. Yeah. Like this happens and they say this and then this happens and they say this. It's real stripped down, you know, beat sheet kind of stuff. So
when we're, you know, talking about Merriam and Blackbeards, you know, what do you think it is that drew you to that kind of story? Were you trying to put out a theme or a lesson into the world, or was it just about the character herself?
It was just about the character herself, but I had my own realization. Like it sounds completely shallow and myopic, but you know, as you hit a point, like people in your life start to perish, grandparents and then an aunt and then, you know, a friend from school. And you're just like, you kind of start to have that happen. I mean, it's a normal thing, unfortunately, but as you realize that people are dying, you also come to the realization like, oh, right. Me too. Right. It's not just you. I am also going to do that. So we're all just going to heat death of the universe eventually. Cool. And that's weirdly, you know, crushing. Because like when you're a teenager, you're like, woo, I can't die. And you're like, you know, I'm going to jump into this quarry. It's probably fine. So I wanted this character that was grappling with that in a very literal way, because she can see how you're going to die when she touches you. And I thought that would be a sort of a twisted, perverse power fantasy over death, because her power over death and the sight she has over death is very complicated, and her ability to affect it is like moving mountains. It's not something that came easy. So while she has this power trip and this power ability, it's fraught and complicated and dangerous for her. So I just really wanted to have that. And then to put it in the body of this sort of small, angry woman, I thought was just a lot of fun. She's just venomously foul-mouthed, which people think is me. Like they think, which I am, very foul-mouthed. But a lot of the women in my life, including my current wife, she's incredibly foul-mouthed. Fouler-mouthed than I am. Like she has a Miriam spirit about her, and that's definitely part of why I put that there. Like we came back from the shore one time, and this is where people are like, you can't, it's a very male book. It sounds very male. So we came back from the shore, and we had shells. You get caught shells along the beach with your kid. Mm-hmm. I guess one of those shells contained something that was not yet dead or scraped out.
Oh no.
So we jarred something up that when you unjarred it, did not smell particularly wonderful.
Oh.
So upon unjarring, opening that jar in the bathroom, my wife exclaimed, it smells like Aquaman's taint in here. And I was like, there it is.
Oh, wow.
It's not me.
You're like, that's why I married that woman.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. That's so good. Such a good one.
Perfect. That, actually, that makes it all make sense, to be honest.
Yep. Yep. All makes sense. Talking to you.
Now listen, like attracts like, you know?
Yep.
Do you think that family and having their appreciation for how you can tell these stories is extremely important to you continuing to do it?
It's not extremely important that they're into what I write. I'm glad that they appreciate it. Like my wife no longer reads my books because I've stopped asking her, because I write very disturbing stuff and she just doesn't, she's not super into like the really dark, squirrely, horror-y stuff. My son up until recently was not super interested in, I mean, he knew I wrote and was not like dismissive of it, like whatever, but he was never in any way we're like, oh my God, my dad's a writer and it's wonderful. But I have a middle grade coming out in fall called Dustin Grimm, and he is super excited to read it. And he's like, I'm going to be a writer someday, except I'm also going to be a writer and an artist. So I was like, oh, well, you're upgrading yourself, which is really the whole point. You're upgrading your, you know, me plus someone else. So that's what you, that's what I want you to be.
That's perfect. Yeah. I mean, you know, when I think about, you know, leaving that legacy and pushing forward for the family, it's always interesting to me in keeping that in bounds of having respect for what your other family members do, which you don't have to necessarily be up on everything and every page. You know, one of the things that I really love about support networks, you know, friends and whatnot, you know, I have not read everything you've ever written, and you have not read everything that I've ever written, and that's perfectly okay. And that's that should be the way it is. You know, how do you think it is in this world where we have so many connections? You know, what do you think about support and friendship?
Well, I think it's vital and complicated, because as you get older, it gets weirder to have support and friendship from people. Like, some of my biggest friendships are honestly with people who are not physically present in my life. You, you know, writers like Kevin Hearn, Delilah Dawson, Stephen Blackwell, people who, you know, are, I'm very close to or I love dearly, but I don't see them almost ever. Like, I haven't seen some of these people in over a year now, in part because of the pandemic. But, you know, I mean, I have some, obviously, some local friends, some meat space friends, as it were, which is to say it's just mannequins stuffed with meat. I just talk to them.
It's strange. The butcher puts up with it, but okay, sure.
Yeah. Exactly. It's all right. You know what? I pay him well. You'll take it. So I think it's vital, but it's complicated. It's not, you also have to be careful who, for lack of a better term, you let in, because not everybody is simpatico with each other. And sometimes you can find out that you're not good for each other. Just like in any relationship, you can find out that your friendship is fraught in a way you don't know, especially if you have friends with other writers, can be tough sometimes, because writers are a very squirrely, anxious people. And we compare everybody to everybody else. So that can be tough. But I think once you really find those people, it's like having scales ripped off your eyes in the sort of biblical sense of Paul and Saul on the road to Damascus.
I mean, that's sort of what it is. And even in social media, right? You have these, you know, people that you hang out with, and, you know, it's very public. And, you know, I would love to get your thoughts on that as well. Like, you know, how has it been for you with having very public relationships and then those friendships trail off due to one reason or another? And, you know, and people then think they have a right to sort of ask you about that.
It's weird. Yeah, it's weird. And sometimes people don't know that it's trailed off. So they continue to try to talk to, like, both of you, or have a, you know, loop you into conversations. And you're like, no. No, I mean, it's fine. You know, it's normal life. But unfortunately, like I said, with Twitter, because everybody's sort of on the stage, you're living everything so publicly, it gets difficult to have an internal private life in that regard. And it is one of the nice things about having more meat spacey friends, my you know, meat mannequins. They're not there on social media, or if they are, they're more backgrounds in terms of me dealing with them, and I'm, you know, background to them. So it's not like there's no performance there. There's no, like, industry connection. There's no, you know, necessary bits happening that everyone has to see and be entertained by. So, yeah, but that's the trick with social media, is because you're, you know, you're living your life one quarter tweet at a time.
That's right, Diesel. Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, it was not good. By the way, I'm still drinking this weird cucumbers. Spinach, apple, celery, lemon.
I think it's fermenting, and it's actually, yeah.
Yeah. It's like...
No, every time you drink it, for those of you who are not watching, it's this green substance. And every time he takes a sip, it looks like he just drank some sort of fermenting body juice.
It's like pond water.
How do you know pond water tastes like?
I've had a pond, and I have... Yeah.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
What do you think, when you're talking about, you know, friendship and that, how do you navigate the waters, particularly for those of us out there who are in this middle grade area where we're not the rock famous, you know, but we have more than one person who knows our name? How do you navigate that world between figuring out who wants to be your friend and who wants to have access to your world?
It's tough. Mostly I just I try to be, I adopt the idea. First of all, I try to be helpful wherever I can be, regardless of whether or not someone is a friend. If they're asking in a way that seems earnest, I try to be helpful or informative to the best of my ability and to the best of my limits. But I also, you can usually tell when someone is like, as soon as you start talking to them, they're like, they have an ask. And it's not like, you know, there's no conversation. It's like they get right down to like what they want. And sometimes that thing they want is, you know, too much, or like, you know, you I'll find it on Twitter sometimes, and it's, I try to be very firm and kind, but although sometimes I've just started to ignore it, where you'll find a new follow and you're like, we're following each other. That's cool. And then, you know, they'll be like, hey, can you retweet this? And it'll be a DM to do it. And it's like, not like a thing to do with me, or has, I don't mean like me personally, but I mean, it's not a topic that I would have anything to do with. It's just some Medium article they wrote, and you're like, okay, I don't know if I'm going to do that. Like, I don't have time to read it right now, and I really only want to retweet something if I've taken a look at it. And God forbid I retweet something, and then in the middle of it, it's like some hate screed. And you're like, oh, God, I should not have retweeted that automatically on behalf of this stranger. So, but then they do it again, and then they'll do it again. And there was like a comic author for a long time who, he was constantly like, can you retweet my Kickstarter? Hey, man, I'm doing a new Indiegogo. Can you retweet this? Can you retweet? And it'd be like, but there'd never be anything of my work signal boosted. And I did. I signal boosted pretty much all of them. And I didn't ask him to signal boost anything because I don't want to. I figure, like, if I'm doing it for you, you can eyeball what I got going on and, right, and toss it back without there being this, like, forced quid pro quo. And then I was like, nope, unfollow and block. Sorry, you burned out that relationship, sir.
Yeah, you don't want to burn those kind of friendship bridges. I mean,
no.
You know, when you're talking about mental energy and that kind of thing, you know, how do you balance that out? How do you keep that center zen of not letting people like that kind of drag you down?
That kind of thing doesn't usually drag me down. It's just the type, it's just like a little poke to my cerebral cortex. I'm like, oh, that's kind of irritating. But yeah. Twitter can be sort of just draggy sometimes, just because you can get caught up in something without even knowing you're caught up in something, or stuff can be, or you watch it happening to other people. A main character of the day who, even if you don't like them, you can start to be like, oh, it's starting to get weird. Like, it started off in a way like, I don't like your story, I'm going to be mad at you. But then, like, what's going 2 days later, and there's like, this person should kill themselves. You're like, well, I don't know that was a thing. Maybe you could have just been like, I don't like this, and then stopped there and not told them to die. That would have been, yeah, that would have been a good place to stop. So that can be sort of crushing, just sort of getting the random, you know, because sometimes people just roll up on me and be like, I hate your books. I mean, thank you. All right. Okay. And that's fine once in a while. Like, that's like one of those doesn't bother you. But some days there's like five people or something. You're just like, all right. And it doesn't matter if there's 20 other people who are not saying that. It feels like, you know, the salad bar is great, but one piece of rat poop in the salad bar will have ruined it.
Yeah, unfortunately, the human mind tends to focus on that one negative and not the 100 positives.
Yes.
Yeah, I know that was something that we spoke about years ago, just in negative reviews and whatnot. And
yeah, you got to try to tune that out. But Twitter's like, I can tune out negative reviews because I don't go looking for them. But Twitter, sometimes they try to find you.
Oh, yeah.
They're like Terminators. They've upgraded. They're a new model of negative review that hunts you in the street.
A little blue bird just knocks on your window. Did you see this? No, I didn't.
I didn't want to see it.
Yeah.
Get it, bird.
What do you, so when you are down in those dark places and you got to pull yourself up, you know, how do you do it? What is the Chuck Lindig methodology for recouping that energy and coming back to the positive?
Either family time, because my kid's wonderful and he has such a vibrant energy, or just, you know, complaining to my wife. She's good at sort of being a sounding board. Or I go look at birds, because birds don't give a shit about what we're doing. They don't care about any of the, they don't, despite Twitter being a bird site, birds aren't on it. They don't know anything about it. They are happy to be up in the trees just singing and pooping and fornicating, whatever they're doing out there. It's, they're living their own lives, and it's like, and it's like Pokemon. You're like, I heard of, you know, the Piggly Jeff, whatever is up there. I'm going to find Piggly Jeff. And you go seek out this animal with your camera. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, you do a lot of pictures with nature and whatnot, you know, on your Flickr and your Tumblr, whatever it is that you are picturing now.
My live journal. My live journal.
GeoCity. Your MySpace top is nothing but birds and one blue jay. Yeah, it makes sense. You know, have you always felt that connection to nature?
A little bit. I grew up go back to the barn. Like, I grew up on an actual farm, and we very, very young, we stopped raising livestock, but we did start to raise unusual animals. So we raised two fawns, two baby deer, in our house for the first year of their lives. And then we began to raise more deer, and we had other animals along the way, like rabbits and pheasants, had a few peacocks. And so, yeah, now I came, and my dad was, despite the fact that he was a hunter, he was also a big nature conservationist kind of guy, and was, you know, he would just go to Colorado and get lost in the woods, like literally just sometimes get lost and try to find his way out, like he's Bear Grylls or something. So I did find a loose appreciation for nature, and I went hunting with him a few times, and mostly I enjoyed the sitting and looking at nature part, and not the part where you're supposed to shoot at the pretty deer, because the deer were our pets. Like, I didn't ever want to shoot at them. So yeah, no, nature was always, and you know, now especially as we come to various environmental natural world crises, I think it's all the more important to be appreciative of the world around us, and also how we navigate it and curate it and protect it.
No, I can fully appreciate that. Do you find that that curation is a process that you're undertaking in more areas of your life? Do you find as you sort of rank up in the ages that you're now working on making sure those spaces of yours are protected?
Yeah, like what do you mean, like my writing spaces or family or?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. It becomes more, though, of course, you know, as you kind of do it, it also becomes a little more automated. Some things don't have to be as attentively addressed all the time. In some ways, that's kind of like nature. The curation of nature is almost like not about controlling it, but about letting it be, especially when it's healthy to be what it is. If you're going to control an invasive species, that's one thing, but sometimes you control an invasive species by simply planting more aggressive native species, something that can outcompete it, but is healthy for the environment, for the area in which you're planting it. So it's not probably a bad metaphor for life in general, to try to, you know, find natural ways to sort of beat back the things that are invasive to you. Spend too much time on the phone, go look at birds, you know, there's the, you know, invasive version of Twitter and then the actual version of birds, and the birds are cooler.
The Twitter thing does seem to be a running thread in this conversation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you think it's because it's social media at this point is just sort of on your mind? Do you find that it's just something that...
It's very on my mind.
Yeah?
Yeah, and it's... well, it's also reality. I mean, it's become... You know, it kind of started that it was, like I said, water cooler. It wasn't really real. I mean, it was real, but it wasn't, it didn't go into the outside world. Like, you didn't, it felt contained to where it was, almost like a game. And then over time, you know, especially with the intrusions of campaigns like Gamergate and things like that, it started to get really real. And then, like, it almost became so real that whatever happens on Twitter has an effect in the outside world. Obviously, we had a president, and I use the most generous cat's buckle asterisk you can put next to that, who used it well, and I say well again with generous air quotes, like, and he used it well. He controlled that space. He ruled over Twitter like a weird Mad Max overlord, and it was one of those things that reminded us, I think, how real Twitter became, and then with all the Russian interference in that, and it became a very dominating presence. Facebook, too, obviously, but in a different way. Facebook, it was more of a sub rosa reality. It's not so much what happens there goes immediately public, but what's happening there is a lot of anti-vax groups. I mean, anytime you're like, I'm going to join this group on Facebook. Oh, it's a local gardening group. And you're like, there's Nazis here. Holy shit. Why are there Nazis in the local gardening group? They're everywhere.
Do you find that is pervasive all over social media, where it is this tool that can be used for good or evil? Or is it, do you think it's mainly some social medias over others?
It's all good and evil just because it's made of people. And anytime you get anything that's made of people, like Soylent Green, there's the chance for good and evil. I mean, I read a book called Invasive, which is about genetically modified killer ants. But really the core point of that book, outside of the fact that it had a sort of a laser lens focus on anxiety, was very much how any technology can be used for good or ill. I mean, all the way down to whether you're talking about splitting the atom or you're talking about a knife. The knife can cut bread or it can kill a guy and take his bread. So, you know, it's all about ethics and responsibilities and how we use it. And social media doesn't have a lot of ethical overrule. There's not a lot going on there. It's still pretty wild westy. I mean, as evidenced by anyone who's ever gotten serious abuse on there, tried to report it, and then you get like 4 months later, they'd be like, we found that tweet you told us about, and we totally agree that was abusive. And then you go and look at the person's Twitter account, and they're still there just abusing people. Mm. This is working fine. Everything is good. That's obviously how it's designed.
Well done, Jack. Yeah.
Good job, Jack.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, now obviously, I would imagine a lot of people listening to this have read a Chuck book or two along the ways. And, you know, your biggest hit most recently was Wanderers. You know, having the AI controlling the world and whatnot. No spoilers for anyone out there. But, you know, when you're coming up with these kind of ideas, as you've answered in 1,000 interviews, I want to go a slightly different way. Where did you think that these sort of nightmares that you come up with, you know, where do you think that they stem from? Did they allow you to come up with these story arcs to sort of explore them?
The nightmares are ever present. They're the air that we breathe, as it turns out. Like, that was the thing about Wanderers. So for a very long time, I had the core mechanism idea of these people who would walk out of their houses and begin to walk toward an unknown destination, sleepwalking one by one. And I didn't know who they were. I didn't know why they were doing this. I didn't know where they were going. And that's no way to tell a story. Like, an idea is not, you know, writers treat ideas like they're precious gems, but they're really costume jewelry. It's all about how you wear it. So I didn't know what to do with that idea for years. And then the buildup to the 2016 election, 2015 started to happen, and I called it my anxiety Voltron. Like, it was like all the things that I was like freaked out about, obviously politics and white supremacy and the post-democratic age and climate change and all of these things, artificial intelligence. They sort of dovetailed together and formed this massive robot. That was the story. Like, suddenly it all fell into place in a sort of a cascading way. I didn't even outline that book. Which is odd for me. It just made sense. It just lined up. And so those nightmares, they're mine. The ones that I put into my books are always uniquely mine. They're not abstractions. They're not things I think, well, I think people are freaked out by this, I'll write it. Like, it's stuff that inevitably has freaked me out or worried me in some way. And so, like a sorcerer, I'm using the book to summon the demons into a summoning circle. And in the book is where I can fight them.
Do you sort of advise people that are dealing with anxiety that this might be an outlet for them to deal with it?
It's certainly an option. I am by no means a psychotherapist, so I will not...
Dr. Chuck Wendig.
Dr. Wendig, yeah. I will not advise them in that it's... I will say it's definitely a good idea to do it, but it's an option. Like all writing advice, it's kind of one of those things that you have to try out and see how it goes.
Yeah, you once told me that all writing advice, and I quote, is bullshit. And, and then you proceeded to give me like 3 pages of writing advice. So,
but do you remember the next part from all writing advice is bullshit?
I do. It was take the kernels that mean something to you.
Also, bullshit fertilizer. That's the key.
True.
Bullshit can fertilize.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're talking about that, just from a mental health perspective, when you're, you know, trying to figure out if writing is for you, if creative arts are for you, you know, in this very highly competitive field, you know, what is it that you tell people, you know, when they're honestly looking for advice? And not the same thing that you've told in a million different interviews, but the actual mental health behind it. I'm curious, what does a Wendig think is the proper way to decide if this is right for you?
You know, I don't know how you decide outside of just trying it.
Yep.
There's really no way to know if it's going to be a thing you can handle. And I've seen a lot of writers who don't handle it well, and they come and go, and they don't, and through no harm nor foul to them, I understand it. It's actually, it can be kind of wearying because, you know, as a writer, you're putting so much of yourself into a book, and then you're pushing the book on a boat, and then you don't know what happens to that boat. And it's very scary because, like, it's going to get an agent is going to have words about it, and an editor is going to have words about it. And then, holy shit, you're going to have reviewers, and you're going to have the actual audience itself. And that's assuming it even gets published in the first place. So there's just a lot, you know, you have to be sort of thick skinned about that to some degree, but also not so thick skinned that you don't let yourself feel what you feel about it. It's okay to feel how you feel about it, as long as it doesn't stop you from doing what you want to do. But I mean, a lot of ways that's probably true for life in general is, you know, you're always going to have tough things, performance reviews or criticisms from friends or family, loved ones. So it's just one of those things where you either line up with the creative life or you don't. And the only way to know that for me, it was to try it. And then to sort of like you know, figure out how you adjust. If you really want to do it, there's ways to mitigate that for yourself and not feel like you're having a garden hose full of sewage that you drink every day. Just making sure it's, you know, you love the part that you control.
What is it about the creative experience that's sort of called to you?
That's a great question. I don't know if it's like...
All right, we're done. Take care, everybody.
Yeah, right. See you later. Goodbye. I don't know. I'm a control freak, so that helps. You know, I was also an introvert, and I spent a lot of time alone, so that definitely helped. So, yeah.
Okay. Then, so, I mean, are you thinking... When you're thinking about creative endeavors in general, and you're thinking about, you know, why we do this, obviously you had your mentors, and they gave you advice along the way. You know, what was the kernels of advice, the fertilizer, I guess, as you would call it, you know, that really stuck with you?
You know, there's a lot of debate, and it kind of happens periodically, bubbles up, where the advice is you should write every day. Mm-hmm. And right now, especially, it's tough. I think we're in a part, and it's why I did a thread on Twitter called Gentle Writing Advice. Mm-hmm. There was someone who started this thread of harsh writing advice about every writer is your competition, and basically you have to kill and eat them if you want to survive, which is awesome. So I started a thread of gentle writing advice, but really, you know, one of those sort of quote unquote harsh pieces of writing advice that goes around is you must write every day. And so now the trend is to push back on that and to say, well, you don't have to write every day. You can have whatever process you want. Maybe you write only on Saturdays, or you write a little here and a lot there, or a lot of days are just thinking days. And that is also absolutely true. That being said, when I was young and starting out, the write every day advice, the button chair, was the advice that I needed. Just because I was young and undisciplined and I didn't know what the heck I was doing. And it really helped me develop, especially in a freelance capacity, the ability to hit deadlines. Because if I wasn't writing every day, then I was procrastinating. And then it was like I was, you know, it's almost like to some degree of exercise. Like I have a certain number of days a week that I run, regardless of really whether I want to. Because if I don't, then it becomes easier. That inertia sort of is easier to stop running. These days, I don't necessarily write every day, but back then I had to. So it's one of those things where I always try to remind people that like your process doesn't have to be your process forever. And what works for you, you know, last year may not work for you this year, 10 years ago, and every book requires its own thing. And so for me, very early on, the piece that stuck was that I needed to write it every day, but now it doesn't work, if that makes sense.
It does. Have you ever wanted to quit?
No.
Never. Okay.
No. I've always, even if I'm not published, I'll keep doing it just because I like it. It's a thing that gives me peace and purpose, as it were.
As in sort of like your lifeblood is just continuing to create these stories.
Yeah. Yeah. Because like, you know, every once in a while, like, you know, we have like a financial advisor. And she's always like, are you guys going to worry about retirement? And I was like, I mean, yeah, but also like, I don't intend to retire. It's not that I, you know, you should say, and I'm not suggesting right. You should be like, I'm fine. I'll be great. I'll always be able to do this. But I don't like, and she's like, well, what age do you plan on stopping? And I'm like, what age am I going to stop? I'm not going to stop until I have to.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. For most people, I think the idea of at least getting off the train pops into their mind from time to time. So you've never felt the point where you're going to stop the train, if you're going to ride it forever. You know, there's obviously ups and downs in the valleys, you know, for the train.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think are some of your highs and lows as far as like just bouncing up and down?
You know, yeah, it is peaks and valleys. And I always say that like you're part of the job and the way to insulate yourself from the valleys is to, while you're on the peaks, try to like give yourself that ramp to like try to ramp over the valley as much as you can. And it's not always possible, but you're sort of preparing for the downtime, whether it's financially or creatively or whatever it is. You're just going to hit walls. I have them. I mean, haven't had a huge valley in a while, but you have a lot of little ones, like a bad review or a book comes out and it doesn't do well, or just like little things, or like I said, even one person being on Twitter be like, your book sucks, man. Like, well, there's a valley. That's my valley today. I'm in that valley now. Thanks, jerk. Okay, good times.
That's great. I mean, just having the point that that everyone thinks that he speaks in valleys as, you know, you won the Nobel Peace Prize, and then, you know, you made someone decide that you no longer are allowed to write in any medium whatsoever. And they think about these extremes, but that's not how life is. Life is like, yeah, someone tells you that you got a bad day and you had a bad review, and you're like, darn it, that sucks. You know, and the next day, three people say you're good, you know.
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot of little ups and downs, and sometimes they feel a lot bigger than they really are. So far, I haven't had any of these like career-ending downs, or I'm like, well, I've got to figure out a new thing now. It's like, uh-oh, that didn't work out. Time for a pseudonym.
Yep. Well, you know, Windig Chuck would be my advice for you. Yeah.
We're gonna go with Wok. Wok Chendig. I think that's gonna be fun.
Okay.
Yeah, very natural sounds. It flows right. It's like almost like French. It's beautiful.
That does sound very like I want to read a bidet book from you or something. Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, you know, and I think that is an absolute great segue into, you know, human versus persona. You know, we all talk about online personas and whatnot. You know, how much would you say of what you do as a creative medium is you, or is this, you know, Chuck character that you have sort of created?
It's mostly all me, just because I'm too lazy to control two versions of me. I don't think I'd get that right. I'd be like, well, wait, which one am I today? Oh, God. And then blood would arc out of my head and I'd fall down. So, you know, it's like the stuff I put on Twitter that's sort of inane thoughts about bees or whatever. Like, that's it's in my head. Like, it's not, I'm not like, what would my cool audience think of? I should try to get some buzz with a cool viral tweet. I'm just like, bees. And it's just like, I say bees are fun. Let's talk about this. And it just comes out of my face. That being said, you know, over time you do learn, again, as that Twitter experience sort of transitions from water cooler to like just hanging out with your writer friends to like, oh, the entire world is listening and we're all on a stage yelling at each other. Like, you do start to sort of modulate and moderate that persona a little bit, and, you know, learn to like, I'm like, oh, I should definitely shut up more. Like, that's an important thing.
I don't think I've ever met anyone who is better at leaning into their weird, as the kids say nowadays. At least if I looked at my recent kids' dictionary, I believe that's what they say. You know, what do you sort of think about or have advice about for people listening about sort of not only just leaning into the weird, as they would say, but, you know, really just embracing who you are versus trying to be who everyone else wants you to be?
Well, I think what it is that life is ultimately short. Sometimes it can feel long, but it's short. And you get what you get, and you don't know what happens next. And so why do differently? First of all, it's a lot of work to be someone who you aren't. It's a lot of work to put out artifice and the meat back. Like, it's a lot of work to build that thing that you're not. And it's so much easier to be, I mean, unless the thing that you are is like a Nazi, then don't be that thing. Stop being that thing. Get out of my gardening group on Facebook. You know, and then when it comes to the creative life, you know, the things that really click with people, and especially if you look back and you see all the stuff that's successful, that usually is not part of a trend, but a thing that sets the trend. It's usually someone had a really some kind of inkling, some desire to tell that story, to write that down, to film it, to put art to it, whatever it was. And I think that's noble. Not to say you can't think about the market, you can't try to imagine, is there someone there who will read this? But I mean, storytelling at the end of the day, and probably art making in general, is kind of an act of optimism. It's an exhortation against loneliness. It's like you saying, this thing that I'm writing, I'm the audience for it, but I'm also going to choose to have faith that I'm not the only audience for it, that there's other people out there like me. That's not everybody. I understand that it's not literally going to be everybody, but the people who are my people, who are like me, will read it. And I am not alone, and I am not a unicorn who's, when I perish, it will be the last of me. Like, there are other people out there who are sort of ululating your weird cave song back to you, which is wonderful.
What do you think about legacy? Is that something that ever comes into your mind?
Every once in a while, I start to be like, will there be a legacy? I mean, there will be in a short term. People, when you die, and then there's always a flurry of like, what will that mean? And who was this person? And what did they write? And you also know that that can go away. So, I mean, there's been many writers who we have forgotten more. We've forgotten more than we remember. So, you know, it's easy to believe that could happen. But I also, you know, then I'm like, well, I don't, what am I going to worry about? Like, I don't have to worry about that. That's someone else's problem. That's my son's problem or my wife's. Like, you guys worry about that. And I'm out of here. Like, that's legacy's over. Game over.
That makes sense. What would you, you know, what would you like it to be?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think I'd ever want anything complicated. I just, if people keep reading my books, that'd be pretty cool. I'd take that.
So you don't want like a statue?
No statue. No statue? That's just a pigeon shit magnet right there. I mean,
you do like birds, so...
Yeah. Now, however, asterisk, this one not a cat's butthole, if you could put the statue and then put me inside of it.
Oh.
As like a dead guy, like a mummy, that'd be great. We can do that.
Like the curse? Like you want to be cursed? I don't know.
No, I don't want to be cursed. Like I just want to be like in a statue and then someday, like maybe like the wind comes and knocks it over and then there's like me inside. And they're like, Jesus, God. You're like, yeah, that's right. It's a dead body in that statue. You didn't know that.
That's freaky. And also I thought you wanted me to go like kill tag Brandon Fraser to come in and like, you know, fight you or something.
I'll take that. But you know, I don't want to. He's precious. We don't want.
He is a precious being.
Yeah, he's a precious. He's a beautiful marshmallow man now. I don't want to fight him. He's sensitive and wonderful.
He seems to be. I mean, I will say, you know, people tell me that I have some celebrity friends. You, my friend, beat the heck out of me in that category. You know, best friends with Lin-Manuel Miranda as well as, you know, others. These kind of relationships that just organically start on Twitter. You know, what's it like for people out there who are like, oh my God, it must be so amazing to be friends with all these celebrities. What's it really like?
There's only a few of them I would consider myself actual friends with. Some of them I'm like in an orbit of.
Yeah.
Some of them are like actual like emailing or texting friends or occasional get together friends, which is always interesting. It's nice. I mean, the great thing about some people is they're people. Like, I think we have this idea of celebrity that they're sort of narcissistic monsters who are like, you know, they just chew through people. And I'm absolutely 100% sure there are people out there like that. I've heard horror stories and we've seen some of them play out in the press. Or it could be Armie Hammer, who's apparently a cannibal. That news I still haven't figured out how that even works. They're obviously not the ones you were ever going to be friends with in the first place. Not like Armie Hammer was going to call me, except maybe to eat me because the meat mannequin thing. I'm delicious. Armie, why do you never call me? it's just cool to have people who are people and also respect them. Like for me, the thing about them that's most interesting is not that they're celebrities, but that they're artists. And artists at working at a really just a phenomenal caliber. And like someone like Lin works tirelessly and he's incredibly capable, gifted creator in so many directions. And that's inspiring and wonderful, just like, you know, it is to have any writer friends. Some of my writer friends they're astonishing talents. To just watch them do what they do and to surpass themselves at every turn and in their own way and in their own direction is always really awe-inspiring to see.
I feel like every interviewer in the world would always be like, which one's your favorite? Just so that you alienate every other one you've got. So I'll ask you, what's your least favorite?
Book?
No. Person.
Oh. Yeah, least favorite person?
Yeah, I just wanted to get you in trouble with somebody.
In the whole world?
No, I know who that is. No, your least favorite celebrity friend. That way they won't send you a Christmas card anymore.
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't have any least favorite celebrity. Yeah, they're
he
all
does. Friends. He just doesn't want to say it. That's fine. Yeah. All right. I understand.
Yeah. No, I haven't.
So I wouldn't be doing my job as an interviewer if I didn't get you to decline at least one question.
Yeah, that's true. You did it.
Did.
Now it's you. It's you. Now you're my least.
Yeah, I did it.
It's never you.
No, I appreciate that. You know,
Brendan Fraser.
Brendan Fraser. Paul Chuck Wendig.
Yeah.
I think that the one thing that I got asked the most when telling people that I'd be interviewing you was to find out really what is your inspiratory drive? What is it that's really continuing to keep that fire lit within you?
Oh, like creatively or just in general?
No, just you. Like literally running you as a person. Like what is it that keeps you going every day? Like everyone in the world always asks you, how do you write so many books? How are you so prolific? Listen, they can go Google that. We want to know here, like what keeps you running?
I mean, it's cliche, but like my son, he's just such a cool dude. And I want to demonstrate that to him and try to model good behavior and to keep him sort of in the game, in the humanity game, and have him be an empathic, creative person and critical thinking person. So that alone is enough to keep me going. But I'm a very fortunate and, dare I say, privileged person. And so I'm just super lucky to be able to do what I do. And I feel like it would be very dismissive and disrespectful to not continue to have that fire, to continue to do what I do in a daily way. Just because I have that privilege. And, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. I think we all need that sort of North Star to, you know,
yeah,
continue to guide us on our way.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's important.
Absolutely so. You know, you tell me, what is it that you think you want people to know about continuing to be a good person? What is it that you wish people would take away from, you know, all of your online teachings in how to be?
Oh, God. Don't
lessons.
Don't listen to me. That's probably your first good bet right there is don't. I'm not your North Star. Whoever you are, don't look to me to be your North Star. I don't know. I just think empathy is key, and that's not always sympathy. Sympathy can be essential, but sometimes it can also be dangerous, or toxic optimism can be a problem. But I mean, empathy and just trying to understand where people come from and having a view of other people outside yourself and other experiences and to recognize privilege, they're good lessons. We're all works in progress. We're all trying to do better. And sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. But I think the goal is to try to do better and to try to do better in a way that's not just better for yourself, but is ideally bettering a world and bettering the people either immediately around you or just sort of in general.
That is perfect. Well, my friend, I cannot believe it's already been an hour of us talking.
God, has it really?
It has really been an hour of us talking. And
see, that's a sign. That is a mark.
I know, right?
Because like sometimes you're on these things, you're like, okay, what time is it? It's time. We just sort of cycle through this. You got any four more questions? It's like, just wrap them up and put them into one question.
Yeah. Just are we still here? Oh, it's been 3 minutes. Oh, God. Yeah.
Okay. He's going to be long. Oh, no.
But I do. You're lucky. I have 10 more questions for you. And these are the rapid fire questions.
Lightning round.
Now, you do not have to do one word answers, but they are rapid fire. I will not interact with you about them. I'm just going to ask the question. We'll let you answer it. And they're going to ramp. They start off really easy.
Okay.
Really hard.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Favorite color?
Blue.
Least favorite color?
Orange.
The best thing you've ever tasted?
First answer is, I'll say, I had fish tacos one of the first nights I went to Hawaii, and I was tired, and I hadn't eaten in a very long time, and I was jet lagged, and fish tacos. I don't know if they were great fish tacos or not, but they were that night.
Okay. Worst thing you've ever tasted?
Oh, this pond water. boy, I don't know if I've had just vomit is gross. Anytime you have vomit in your mouth, you're like, God, the human body is garbage. What are we doing with this? Keep that down. Don't put that out.
Have you ever loved?
I hope so, yes.
Have you ever hurt someone?
Oh, of course.
How does someone earn your trust?
Bag of cash. No, surreptitiously left on my doorstep, and it should have the big comical cartoon money symbol on it just so I know what it is. I don't know, stand tall for someone. It doesn't even have to be me, but just watching people stand up for other people is always a sort of that gives you a sign of trust in a way that's more than just like, I can tell you secrets, but just like in a way that they give an indication of being a good person who works for other people.
Okay. How do you lose your trust?
Don't put a bag of cartoon money on my front step. That's how I know I can't trust you. I don't know. Betrayals are always sad. Like anytime someone betrays you in some way where they feel like, and I don't just mean like betrays like your feelings. I just mean like a literal, like, hey, that thing I wasn't supposed to tell people, I'm going to tell somebody that. And you're like, God damn it. What the hell? So that, yeah, betrayals.
Okay. If someone spoke to you the way you speak to yourself when no one else is around, would you be friends with that person?
I'd say 5 days out of 7, but those last 2 days, I'd be like, you need to do better. I'm usually not too hypercritical of myself anymore. When growing up, I would not have wanted to have been friends with that person.
Okay. If you died tomorrow, what do you hope people remember you for?
Wow. Definitely not my tweets. Well, I'll take it easy. I'll just say the books. I mean, I really just want people to remember me for the books. Like, obviously, I want my son to remember me for being a good dad, but I don't want the world to remember me for being a good dad. Wendig, he was a good dad to all of us, wasn't I?
Dad Wendig.
I'd rather just be your weird uncle, like your weird forest uncle.
You'll always be my weird uncle, buddy. The big question. Do you have a personal life philosophy that you would attribute to getting where you are today?
A personal life philosophy that I would attribute to getting to where I am today? I don't know that I do, because I don't have one philosophy that has stuck with me, if that makes any sense. It's evolved, just like the work evolves, just like who you are as a person, a parent, a friend, it evolves. But I do feel like finishing what you started is part of it. It helped me with writing and helped me with completing just simple tasks and projects, and just a reminder to try to finish what you begin. If you're going to begin, you don't begin something if you don't intend to finish it.
Yep. And the ending question, do you believe that some things are better left unsaid?
Right, this is where I just say nothing, right? I just don't answer it, right? And that's the Kobayashi Maru of that question. Yeah, of course, definitely.
And with that, we end the podcast. Thank you so much, Chuck Wendig, for coming on and talking to us.
It's been wonderful. Thanks, man.